I just tipped my water over on my keyboard. It's okay though, we're good.
All right. Welcome to another episode of Jabber and the Drone, the movie review podcast that politely disagrees to agree. You are Richard Wally from Portland, Oregon.
And you are Cassidy Robinson from California. Orange County, Garden Grove.
Oui. Bonjour. Bonjour, Monsieur Wally.
What in the fuck is going on this episode?
Today we're going to be reviewing As Above, So Below, and Amelie. So this officially is the most French episode we've ever done.
Oh, I see where you're going with this.
Bonjour!
No, I'm not going to do that. I don't believe in that language. It's too hard.
You speak a romantic language.
It's not true. You always say this. It's a lie, everyone.
When I was watching it, and, you know, it always takes out like that first 5 minutes of adjusting what you're hearing and what you're reading at the same time. And I was thinking to myself, Richard probably can catch about every third word. I bet he only needs to kind of read the subtitles.
No, that's not true.
Not true at all?
I have to read the subtitles. I do catch words. That's true.
Yeah.
I catch nesses. I could probably get through it if I tried, but... Why would I do that when I could just turn on the subtitles?
You don't want to Rosetta Stone you into another language via Amelie?
It doesn't work that way.
I don't think ISU understood that, though, because their idea of doing lab hours was watching foreign films.
Well, it does help, and it does, if you're paying attention to the language, but I'm guessing you put the subtitles on and just kind of read the subtitles and ignored what they were saying.
Because
That's what I think most people do.
It's what you have to do.
I don't in Spanish.
You don't? Like, you just watch it as is and chill?
Sometimes, it depends on the movie, where it was made.
Yeah.
What kind of Spanish they're speaking, how slangy it is. It just depends.
All right. So if it's like a 1980s Spanish B-boy movie, you probably couldn't get as much out of it as, like, a...
B-boy. What does B-boy mean? I don't even know what that means.
Like a breakdancer.
Oh, okay. Keep going.
Than if it were, like, an aristocratic from Spain Spanish movie.
I have an easier time because one of my teachers, she was from Spain, so I understand that dialogue pretty well.
Okay.
It just depends. Since it's one of my second languages and it's not something I've known since I was a kid, it takes a little bit to start up the machine and it takes a little bit to get everything going. So just depends.
Well, this is episode 101.
It's pretty fancy.
It's the first episode we've done just the two of us, since we've been, going long enough to go into syndication.
Because we just reached that mark.
Yeah, 100 episode mark. Last week we had on Leland from the Damper Cast to celebrate episode 100 with us. That was fun.
I already miss him.
I'm sure
he's
you
so
do.
Funny.
You have such a man crush.
He's just so fun to podcast with. He's not like you.
I am kind of a drag.
You always want to talk about serious stuff and
yeah.
Sell up your own whatever wazoo about movie critic stuff. Mm-hmm. Film.
It's not like it's the subject of our podcast or anything like that.
No, it's not. Apparently it's about Richard speaking a different language and me belittling you. That's what apparently the subject is.
Yes.
But anyone listening to the first time, this is a film review podcast, and we actually do talk about movies eventually.
Eventually, we'll get to it. But speaking of being, like, whatever, film criticism and all that stuff, I am in school again. I just finished my first week. I talked to you a little bit about it on the Facebook.
Oh yeah, you're talking to me as a person.
Again. Yeah,
sure.
I'm addressing you now.
I remember that. Okay.
Yeah. And kind of a we've been a crazy semester so far. Only one weekend, and it's been a crazy semester. Especially in like the bureaucratic end of like, you know, all the different departments that have to talk to each other to make sure that I get money.
That's a concern.
Yeah.
You eating and paying for your schooling and all that. That is a concern.
Mm-hmm. And this is the last year I ever have to worry about this. And so in my mind, I keep thinking like next year, I'm going to fucking get be on top of this. And then I keep remembering, oh, I don't have to worry about that. This is the last time I have to do this, which you would think would alleviate all of the rage, but it actually makes me more angry because it's not even like I'm learning something from this.
Well, next year, they're going to demand money from you.
Yeah, that's a whole other.
They're going to start breaking your fingers and knees until you
bang. Yeah, that's a whole other sitch. We'll see what
also
happens.
I have to give a shout out. A little bit.
All right.
I don't usually do this. You know that.
Yeah.
Our technical advisor, Daniel Robertson, just had a child with his wife, Mindy Crouchley. Congratulations.
Oh, does he have a name?
She does. Audrey Luna Robertson.
Audrey, like Audrey Hepburn.
That is correct.
Is that what they named her after?
I'm going, you know, or they just like the name.
Yeah.
But yeah, sure.
They say that people name their children after their grandparents' generation. Like, every generation starts, the names that are popular are the ones from their grandparents' generation. So that would make sense.
I'm not naming my child Verda.
Well, not like your actual grandparents, but names that were popular from that generation.
Oh, okay.
You don't really hear Audrey from, like, our parents' generation, but you do hear it more from our grandparents' generation.
That's just because they're lame. We don't need to talk about
that. Yeah, they're like Sunbow and Raindrop and, yeah.
Chicken Feather.
That's going to be my first kid.
I like that name, actually, yeah.
I bet you do. That or...
Chicken Feather.
That or Wicket, named after the Ewok.
Yeah, of course. Or Willow. Wicket and Willow. These are my children.
Willow would work, because that's unisexual. So, you know, if you had
had another kid named Wicket,
mm-hmm.
then people would be like, I see what you're doing here. That's not funny. That's rude.
I just had a conversation with my friends the other night, and two of them are a couple, and they're talking children because they just got engaged. They have some pretty gnarly fucking name ideas. So Wicket and Willow are like really normal in comparison.
Oh, well, I was once, because I have this weird thing where the boys have to be an RDW name that has to be the initials.
Yeah.
And, somebody suggested to me Rape Dirt Wally.
Nope.
That's a pretty bad
nope,
one.
Nope. Right? I'm going to go ahead and say no on that one.
Yeah. We
not even too, my decision, but no.
Fair enough. I agree.
I will not let that happen. I will call child services.
I give you permission.
Good. Well, let's go ahead and get into the show, the real show, and we're going to talk about some movie news. And I'll go first. Robert Downey Jr., Robbie DJ, as he's known pretty much everywhere, says that he has no plans to return for Iron Man 4. He is, you know, contracted to be in the next Avengers movie, which I think they're already more or less filming, or at the very least in pre-production. But after that, balls in the air. Now, what's interesting about this is, you know, this is, you know, the Marvel monolith that has been built mm-hmm. has pretty much been built on the house of Robert Downey Jr.'s Iron Man.
Mm-hmm.
Can the monolith exist without the foundation?
I think we very much saw that this year. I think there's been a new fire ignited, and they've gotten, because it seems like they were kind of like rickety, and it seems like that was kind of the one that people were going to.
Mm-hmm.
But I think after Captain America 2 and Guardians of the Galaxy this year, I think they show that they can do some really great movies outside of
Iron Man.
And honestly, I think that these two movies are better than any of the Iron Man movies. So I personally, in my very not so humble opinion, I think they can.
Right.
I think he has contracted through the third Avengers. If he only has through this, I think, I actually keep wondering in my mind, I keep going, who's Joss going to kill? He's going to kill someone soon. He has to.
And it would make sense for him because he wants to get out, and B, it would be the beloved character. Nobody wants to die.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it would be in the worst way possible. He'd probably just die of like alcohol poisoning or something like
that. Real quietly. In a prologue to the actual film.
Yeah, it'll be like...
It'll set the mood for the whole thing. Yeah, I mean, there's two things they could do. They could either kill him off like that or just write him out like, oh, he's over in Spain doing something, God knows what. Or they could recast it. Now, do you think anybody else could do that and people would be okay with it?
No, I think we're kind of getting into a time period where they are recasting and it's become okay because like whenever you get like a Sean Connery and then right afterwards, I forgot who the next Bond was, but it seems like
Roger Moore,
there you go. That's all you needed to say.
Mm-hmm.
So you go from a Sean Connery to a Roger Moore and people are not okay with the recasting.
Yeah.
I think whenever you have a really popular kind of iteration of a character, the next one, they're going to hate even if it's a better iteration. I don't think Roger Moore was. I'm just saying that there's sort of a bias already built in.
Yeah.
So with Iron Man specifically, no. No matter who they cast.
Yeah.
It could be Tom Hiddleston. And they would not. And I mean,
well, that would just be confusing.
Him. Or Benedict Cumberbatch or whoever.
Yeah.
That would be just as confusing.
The most nerd-friendly actor you could find.
And who received the most love online.
Yeah.
I feel like every day I get this, like, I up in my feed comes up a thing about their profound love for Tom Hiddleston and Benedict Cumberbatch every day without fail. So I'm beginning to hate them. They're fine.
No, but it's interesting because, like, you look at, like, Batman, which has had several iterations. We've had, you know, Michael Keaton, Adam West... you know, whatever. There's been a lot. You know, most recently Christian Bale, and now we're going into Ben Affleck. And there was initially a huge online backlash against that, but I feel like people are more or less emotionally prepared for it now.
I think that's part of it. The other part of it is, you know, like, so, I mean, Adam West was a very popular Batman, but there was also like a 20-year gap between the show and...
Yeah.
And the next iteration. So I think that always helps as well.
Well, also, so I don't know. But I think that specifically the difference between these two characters, Batman and Iron Man in the movies, is that Batman, as well as Bond, are kind of known for different people playing them. And each iteration having a different tone, a different take. Whereas Iron Man and Tony Stark and Robert Downey Jr. are inexorably linked. Like, the DNA... is the same, you know. It's like,
well, they shouldn't have cast. Well, they should have, but don't get me wrong, the casting was superb.
Yeah.
But the casting was almost so superb that it's literally like when he was cast, I was like, oh, Tony Stark does exist as a person. Like, it wasn't, there was no dividing line.
Yeah,
it just made complete sense. He and I was just like, oh, okay. And it's hard to kind of, there is almost not a real big divide between them.
Yeah, it's all one and the same. The appeal of Iron Man is the appeal of Robert Downey Jr. But, so I think with that character, you almost would have to wait 5-10 years before people could even, like, begin to accept it.
Maybe even longer.
Maybe even longer. All right, what's your first story?
My first story is they've been working on it for a while, but they finally... are kind of coming down with the director, but they've been developing a Shadow of the Colossus, which is an old original PlayStation game.
Mm-hmm.
Very cinematic and very
moody.
Strange.
Yeah.
It's moody. It's got ambience. It was one of the first generation of games to really start being very, very serious.
Yeah.
And really playing with the medium itself. And they've been trying to adapt it for a while. Well, they finally kind of came around, Sony came around to looking at Andy Muschietti. He's the guy that did Mama.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's who they're kind of looking at for doing this big fantasy
monstery thing. Yeah,
exactly. It's kind of kaiju-y in a way. Mm-hmm. So, and you know what? The one thing that I've got to say about him as a director, whether you didn't like the movie or not, most people could say was positive about Mama was the ambiance of the film, mm-hmm. which Shadow of the Colossus needs a lot of.
Yeah.
And also, I think he did pretty good character design for the Wisp, and also just using the silhouette of it a lot, and not just going full out.
Blowing his monster load. Yeah.
Yes, blowing his monster load.
I know very little about this game. I remember it selling very well when I worked at Walmart. And it had kind of a cult following in the video game world.
Still does.
Yeah, still does. And that's saying something, considering I don't think there's been multiple sequels.
There haven't. As far as I can tell. I didn't play the game in depth, but I was always a fan just because of how much attention to detail and everything they did for the game. I would always like to go back to it, which is still on the list to do of many things in my life. But
get to it.
I hear you're going to kill me soon.
You have a short amount of time to get to that list.
Thanks for letting me know.
You might want to start there. I'll get on that.
What's your next news article?
David Fincher and James Ellroy are plotting a 1950s crime noir series for HBO. David Fincher, obviously famous director, Fight Club, Social Network. Right now he's the executive producer of House of Cards on Netflix and directed a few episodes of that. And James Ellroy is sort of a modern pulp novelist. He wrote the novel in which the movie L.A. Confidential was based.
Right.
Which is a movie I liked a lot.
His stuff's usually pretty gritty. He also gets a lot into, like...
cops and, yeah.
Well, he does that noir thing, but he also does a lot of the Black Dahlia kind of style, kind of killer.
Yeah.
He's got kind of a, not obsession, but kind of a draw to that a lot, so...
Sure. So the two sensibilities, I think, meet pretty well.
I almost will give, it's almost like for television, instead of the college try, it's the HBO try.
Yeah.
So you get a name like that, you get names like that together, and then you put it on HBO, and I'm like, okay, done. I mean,
now
I think we made the joke last week that I would just, even if it just said David Fincher the movie, I would probably,
you were there,
at least give it a try.
Yeah. And I think you've watched more of House of Cards than I have, and you're still on board.
I finished, yeah.
Yeah.
I've watched both seasons. It's decent.
Well, people certainly like it. Yeah. And, yeah, I mean, I see no reason not to be interested in this other than I'm getting a little concerned with all of these high-profile directors giving up on film and moving into TV. We have Steven Soderbergh, who just started his new show, what is it called? The Nick, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So he's done with movies for the moment. And now Fincher's doing more TV. He still has Gone Girl coming out, but I feel like maybe he's starting to transition. And you just see this more and more and more.
Right.
These high profile directors, prestige directors who are kind of losing their interest in film because it's getting so damn hard to get films made now, unless they're have Iron Man in them. And
right.
But on the other hand, you know, Fincher has never shied away from pop commerciality. In fact, he just recently made another like cologne commercial or something. Like even though he's like been nominated for Oscars and all of that stuff, he's never stopped making music videos and commercials, basically to right. just tool around and figure out how to play with new toys.
Well, you know, and sometimes I don't think that's a bad, I think that's good for directors to kind of play in those grounds sometimes so they can learn tools and
yeah.
ways to use a camera and aesthetics and whatever. And it's also almost like a commercial, no matter what it is, you still have to, if you're going to do it effectively, there's certain marks you have to hit. I mean, even as much as, you know, even David Lynch has made commercials.
Yeah, so he still does every once in a while, and they're pretty weird. But
so, I mean, that's not something to, yeah, that's true. I mean, how could they not be?
Yeah.
But really, that's something I never kind of, I guess, marked off.
No.
Because, I mean, movies are so commercial in themselves. Like, they're just so expensive that they have to have the money tied in.
Right.
And so I've never nicked anybody for that. I can see your point about a lot of people moving to TV. I guess the only thing that I would see, maybe some younger directors would rise to the challenge and fill those gaps and learn how to work in the system how it is now,
mm-hmm.
as opposed to how it used to be. So that's the only positive maybe to the big directors moving to TV. Also, I don't think TV is a bad medium. I think it's similar, but
no, it's good. And you know, obviously for writers, it's much better. And for directors who really want to tackle adult topics, it's better. I lament, you know, this idea that film is no longer a place where things can be discussed seriously anymore. And I hope you're right in that, you know, a new generation, maybe people our age or a little bit younger are going to say, well, fuck it. If, you know, Fincher and Soderbergh and these type of people aren't going to be in the game anymore, now it's time to, you know, for my voice to be heard. And then, you know, maybe that's what needs to happen to really kick off a next generation of, you know, auteur filmmaking. Well, if that's all we have for the news, let's go ahead and get into our pet topic, which is your turn.
Sure is. So this week there was this internet STD or game, internet game on the Facebook.
Mm-hmm.
What it is basically there was a list being sent around. It says make a quick list in under 15 minutes of 15 movies that were very memorable to you. Don't take too long to think about it. Just write down a list.
Right.
So I did this, and you also did this. We got this from two different people.
Yeah, and you're supposed to tag 15 people and da-da-da, and you didn't play the game right, and almost nobody I tagged did.
Nobody wants the internet STDs. Anyways, this one was actually kind of fun, and I did participate. And I even thought about passing it on, but then I didn't. what I thought was kind of interesting about it was what the main thing around it was the memorability of the film.
Right.
So I was kind of wanting to go through these lists that we had already made and kind of just talk about what makes them memorable.
Okay. I feel like my list is not very inspired. Like I look at it and it's like, yeah, you go to any top whatever list and those are going to be the movies you see there. It's not that creative or, you know what I mean? Like I could have, if it wasn't put under some sort of pressure of just getting it done, I probably could have thought of a cooler list, if you will. But it'll be interesting to talk about these. Do you want to like read them off first, or do you just want us to go through them? Or,
well, just pick a few and say why. It's more, my question more is about, I mean, you can read them off real quick if you want the whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
But it's more what captures the memorability. What do you think makes these pop out? Because you were like, well, it's not like that, like innovative or whatever, or creative or whatever, but is memorability really, does it have to be like, you know, this list of like Ozu and everything like that?
No. Yeah. I know this isn't like a sight and sound list. This is a more personal list. And some people, you know, really kind of went that angle, and you see a lot of a lot more like kids movies and that kind of stuff, which makes a lot of sense because of the first movies you're seeing. So I'll read off a few here and kind of say why I put them on my list. The first one I have here on here is The Wizard of Oz, which I saw at a really young age. I think most people see that movie at a really young age. We had it on VHS taped off to TV. They used to show it annually. I don't know if they do that anymore, but they would show it. It was like, kind of like It's a Wonderful Life. They would show around Christmas. They would show Wizard of Oz some other time of the year every year on network television. So we taped it, at one point, and I probably watched that tape till it quit working, as I did most of the tapes we had. And I remember the movie has a big impact on me in a few ways. A, it was the first, I'm sure it was the first movie that really kind of scared me, like actually kind of like freaked me out as like a little kid, 4 years old or so, the witch and the monkeys and all of that stuff. There was just, you know, it actually kind of like there were parts I couldn't watch or would kind of freak me out. Then when I got a little bit older, I kind of grew into the movie. And now I kind of see it as just, you know, it's hard for me to look at it as anything other than a big MGM musical in the tradition of MGM musicals. Right. I think it still holds up. I think the music is still really catchy. There's still kind of a dark edge there, like everything with, like, you hear about, like, you know, the first casting of the Tin Man, and he, like, was poisoned, and Margaret Hamilton was burned really badly, and somebody may have hung themselves, and, like, there's all this weird lore that spins around the movie. True or not, it's interesting. Every time I watch that movie, it immediately takes me somewhere. So that's why that one's on there. Let's see.
Well, there's definitely, you were talking about the kid angle, and yeah, and I think everybody does, and it does make sense.
Yeah.
I think that's partially, there's kind of a nostalgia attached to it too, and that's not a bad thing.
No, you know, totally. I'm sure.
Like, I mean, I even think a lot of people, there was ones listed that are kind of weird. People were like, wait, what?
Yeah.
Like, on my list, I have Little Nemo. It was a cartoon I really liked when I was a kid. A lot of people think it's not very good and kind of weird, but I still to this day really like the film.
Mm.
It's got beautiful animation. Besides beautiful animation, it really has a, to me, there's these parts that just have a really cool ambiance to them. And I still to this day kind of sticks with me because of that.
Yeah, that is a totally weird movie. And like that weird, this was made for kids and we don't realize how weird this movie's going to be kind of way. Maybe.
Yeah, it kind of is in a tradition. I mean, the comic itself was in a tradition of like Alice in Wonderland as well.
Yeah.
And so, but it totally does capture imagination. You're like, oh, that's cool.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, it kind of, I guess it's kind of formative in a way.
Right.
Considering some of my other picks like Time Bandits in Brazil and some of my other little movie fetishes and stuff that I have.
Yeah, so. The surrealism. Yeah. Here I have Pulp Fiction and Fight Club, and I'll put these two together because I watched these movies, both of these movies, along with Reservoir Dogs, which I would have put on my list if I didn't already have Quentin Tarantino represented one other way. I watched all three of those movies the same night. Mm-hmm. Me and Keith, who's been on the show before and our friend at the time, we rented all those movies because they were like movies you hear talked about all the time. We were like in high school, so like 16, 17 years old, but we never actually seen them. So we're like, let's go ahead and just watch all those. Mm-hmm. And, man, that is just like hit the spot. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah,
when you're like 16, 17 years old, like you've never seen a Quentin Tarantino movie before. Like it was like, this is film. Like I never knew I wanted. You know what I mean? But apparently this is exactly what I want. So it was just like, you know, the teenage angsty kind of thing, like all kind of violent, but like really, really stylish. And actually, of all of the movies I kind of grew up with around that time have aged the best, and I can watch them and still appreciate them for different reasons.
Yeah.
Well,
I have certain ones like that too, I guess. Like, it seems like yours is kind of almost biopic for you. Like there's a certain movies for certain times where you're
a little biographical,
film,
yeah.
I guess it's because it's always been kind of a part of your life, so it's.
Or the movies I tend to remember have a place somewhere. Yeah.
Right. I mean, because one of mine that just kind of hits the spot, I don't know why, but is The Road Warrior. It's violent. It's quick. It doesn't explain everything. It just goes.
That was on you and Keith's list.
Yeah, it's badass. I don't know what it is. There's something about the aesthetic, the attitude, everything about the film that just kind of hits in the right spot.
Uh-huh.
It's like the chicken noodle soup version of movies for me.
Sure.
I mean, the same Ghostbusters is kind of like that, even though there's a nostalgia attached to it and films and stuff like that. But maybe Texas Chainsaw is like that too. It just hits all the right marks for me as a person.
Texas Chainsaw is your comfort food?
Yeah. Barbecue, you know.
You're feeling sick, you just want to bundle up with a blanket and watch Texas Chainsaw.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Makes sense.
Kind of, yeah. You know.
On here, and you might appreciate this, on my list, I included Happiness by Todd Solondz. And it's not necessarily a film I would say is one of my all-time favorites. I do think it's a really good movie, but I don't return to it very often because it's an incredibly difficult movie. But I remember like seeing that at kind of a formative age. I was like maybe again like 17, 18 years old, maybe just right out of high school. And it was like kind of like a punch in the gut of a movie to watch. If you've never seen it before, it's sort of a dark comedy. It kind of came out around the same time as American Beauty and Little Children and a lot of these kind of like, you know, behind closed doors type of suburban satires.
Well, it's definitely,
and it's definitely the darkest of all of them.
It's definitely the darkest comedy I've ever watched.
Yeah.
It almost tips to the point where you're like, I can't laugh at this. They're definitely timing like this, like a joke.
But yeah.
It's not. It's a rough movie. I can see why it would be memorable at least.
Yeah. I mean, it was, you know, it's like, you know, trying caviar for the first time or something like that. Like it just, it was such an extreme.
Out of the garbage, maybe.
It was such an extreme sensation. I didn't even know how to gauge it. I didn't know if I liked it or whatever. But I ended up kind of returning to it every once in a while, either just to sort of as a dare to like watch it with somebody who hadn't seen it before and right. kind of just get a reaction out of them. I was like, oh my God, you got to see this crazy movie. And then like after the, you know, the third or fourth time I'm doing that, I realized I was like, no, I like this movie. Like this is a good movie. And now that I'm past the point of shock, like I can look at like, you know, how tight the writing is, how incredible the performances are. You know, yes, it's really daring and it's really,
agreed. I don't know how that guy ever got money and was ever able to work in Hollywood again. I mean, considering his subject,
Dylan Baker,
no, I'm not talking about the actors. The actors were all spot
on. Oh, Todd Solondz. Yeah.
Todd Solondz.
Yeah.
Cause usually if a filmmaker would make a film this, I can't believe there's not more controversy surrounding this film, actually.
I think it was, I think, well, it was very limited in its release. The reason I even knew what it was is because I watched like this documentary on IFC that talked about controversial movies, and they talked about this alongside The Opposite of Sex and David Cronenberg's Crash and a few other, The Spanking the Monkey, all of these movies. And I kind of made it my mission to see every single movie they were talking about.
Right.
And so, yeah, that was a period of my life when I was definitely like, seeing how far to the edge I could go.
That goes there.
It does. Definitely does. What else is on your list?
When you say memorable, the reason I think Chinatown right away is just because of the ending.
Yeah.
It just hits you and you know, and you're like, I will remember that.
Oh yeah.
And just how smart and just how well made the movie is. I mean, it all comes together, but the ending itself
mm-hmm.
makes it memorable. So there's that like star. Or I put on I'm a fan of, but one of his, but my favorite movie of Federico Fellini is Il Vitaglione. And the reason why is because to me, it's a very personal film. I found the subject matter and everything that was in it very interesting and alluring.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, it spoke to me as me as a person. Not on a level of just pure aesthetics or anything like that, but as an actual kind of, it was very personal, the message. And so I think that's another way that a film can be very memorable.
Mm-hmm.
Even if it's not, cause I don't think it's by far Fellini's best film.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think it's not a bad one, of course, but it's one of his first.
It's not one that people usually go to, like to name drop Fellini. Yeah.
Yeah. And so this film specifically for me was just personal. I connected with the characters. I understood what he was talking about.
Yeah.
So that's why I liked it.
This one here, and then we can move on to our review.
Sure.
Kind of along the same lines, American Beauty, which I saw around the time that it came on video, so right after it won Best Picture. So there was a decent amount of buzz behind it, but I genuinely wanted to see it, and wasn't even sure why, because I was, at this point, I was like 12, 13, so I was still like, if it's not The Matrix, I don't give a fuck. Like, right, you know what
right,
I mean?
Right.
Like it was like The Matrix, the first X-Men movie, and Ace Ventura were my favorite movies. So
yeah, every boy.
I was just, yeah, I was just very much a preteen boy. But there was something about like the way it looked or the subject matter or like the performances, like from the trailers and like the VH1 special that I watched on the movie that I was just like, I really want to see this movie. And I had no idea what was really drawing me to it. And then when I saw the movie, I was eventually able to see it, you know, away from my parents' supervision. Like, it really kind of hit me in a really specific way because it was the first film where I realized, like, dramas can be badass. You know what I mean? Okay. Like, it doesn't have to have something exploding or a robot or, you know, Jim Carrey talking with his butt or whatever. Like, it was the first thing I watched where it was like, the human condition can fucking rock.
See, it wasn't until I was older that I kind of got that.
Yeah.
I mean, I'd had movies that had happened to.
Yeah.
That had happened to me with that, in that kind of situation. But I didn't really put that together until I was a little bit older and kind of processed.
Yeah, I wasn't thinking about that at the time. I wasn't like, oh my God, this is such a turning point in my life. Right. I responded a lot to the movie and I liked it a lot. And I remember like wanting to buy it and blah, blah, blah. And, you know, putting it there, you know, next to Ace Ventura and The Matrix. And
as weird as it sounds, my first kind of drama that did that for me was As Good As It Gets.
Me too, actually. And I didn't put it on the list cause I didn't think about it, but that was another one where I like went with my parents to see that movie. And I remember, I used to buy my movies on VHS from Kmart, and I would have to like save up, you know, dishwashing money, to be able to buy a movie every once in a while. And, I remember I bought that one after we had seen it, and my parents were both kind of like, really? I'm like, yeah, I like it a lot. And they're like, you want to buy that? Like, cause I was like 12.
Right.
And I was like, yeah, no, I liked it. And they're like, all right. Yeah, don't go ahead.
What I remember is too is because I was never able, my mom wouldn't take me to the movies.
Mm-hmm.
We just rented everything, but it was one of the first movies that I was like, I don't, maybe it was just marketed incredibly well to 11-year-old Mel's.
Yeah.
Which I kind of,
you know what, I think it was probably the inn for our generation, for kids our age, was probably the Jack Nicholson thing because he was the Joker, and we kind of already knew who he was.
Yeah.
By that point, I'd already seen The Shining, so I had like, and it was cool to see him in a movie that wasn't so genre.
Well, that right around then, I decided that I was like, I think 10 or 11 when that movie came out, and I, for some reason, even before that movie, I decided that Jack Nicholson was my favorite actor. So I went through the motions of seeing a lot of stuff. And when that was coming, I was like, oh, that's really exciting. And specifically that film, I don't know what drew me to it either. I have no idea. Because it's really outside of my wheelhouse or my normal kind of like likes
and
interests. So, but yeah, no, I think there's always a film like that for everyone.
Yeah.
So I think that that's kind of an interesting list of things to... You know.
Yeah, it's cool to think of those movies in those terms or to like, you know, what were the big, you know, because, you know, they always talk about like, you know, those moments are from your boyhood, if you want to make another movie reference, where, you know, there was a big moment in your life where things changed. And, you know, for me, a lot of those are kind of punctuated by the pop culture I was invested at the time.
Makes sense.
Well, let's go ahead and get into our movie reviews and we can talk about the immense impact that As Above, So Below had on us this week.
Okay.
Do you want to set that up?
Kind of, I guess. Sure.
Don't let me get in your way.
Yeah. I'm just running for it. As Above, So Below it's kind of a mediocre horror film, but basically it's about this team, this doctor who kind of assembles these people to go down into the catacombs to find this lost hidden treasure in the Philosopher's Stone.
Yeah.
Basically, they go down there, things kind of get flipped on their head, and it becomes this kind of surreal, dark happenings and paranormal, and stuff pops out of the dark, and it's kind of a...
claustrophobic terror and...
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty... the problem with it is, okay, I'm going to say a positive thing about it because it does need to be said.
Mm.
The ideas of the film, actually, I think are kind of cool.
Yeah.
I think going down the whole, you know, the surreal kind of getting into that kind of demon stuff without having to be the exorcist.
Yeah.
I think that all of it is interesting and a good way to go at it.
Mm-hmm.
However, where the movie fails is in its execution.
Right.
And I think most of it is writing, is the where it fails.
Mm-hmm.
Specifically, one of the laziest choices I didn't like about the writing was the cameraman character, the documentarian.
Yeah, this is a sort of a found footage film of sorts.
Yeah. So the found footage aspect of it.
Mm.
First of all, he's not the first person you meet. The doctor is. And why is she doing found footage? Now, basically the only reason that this character exists, this documentarian, is to have a camera in the movie.
Yeah.
And to have a gruesome death later in the movie. That's it.
Spoilers!
Yeah, spoiler. I apologize. kind of. But I don't know. So that I do think that was a really lazy and bad choice. I think a better way to have done this is either start off in the catacombs.
Yeah, it kind of takes a while to get down there.
Or two, the first part isn't in found footage.
Yeah.
You could have easily, she could have been like, I want to document this, so I'm going to turn, we're all going to have cameras. Because it doesn't really make sense as a document. You know, somebody found this footage, and so they spliced and edited together all the parts
of all
these different cameras.
Yeah.
There's some kind of some logical kind of things that you kind of have to go, this doesn't quite pull together.
Yeah.
So, also, I don't think that it's, for found footage, I think some of their found footage is a little too, they shake it a little too much, and they don't set up their shots enough. I know that's not part of the appeal, but I think you still have to think about it in those terms. You're still a visual medium.
Yeah.
Oddly enough, most of the performances were just but I did kind of like one by the actor Ben Feldman. He was the other
archaeologist
guy.
Yeah.
Whatever he was supposed to be. Yeah. I don't know why. I just actually found his performance actually pretty believable. Mm-hmm. Even when he had some very pukey lines where they decide to throw in this like weird romance at the end. I didn't really see it built up to that beforehand. So I was like, oh, okay.
Yeah.
Sideways, we're going to kiss in the dark before bad shit happens, I guess. Okay.
And the lead is played by Perdita Weeks. She plays Scarlet, who is the main archaeologist looking for the Philosopher's Stone. The same Philosopher's Stone from Harry Potter. Nicholas Flamel and everything. Who was, a real dark magician back in the day. Or legend has it, anyway.
Right.
This is a pretty dopey movie. And I think what the film has going for it is, as poorly executed and lazy and kind of perfunctory as it is, it's sort of Saturday morning cartoonish enough to almost make up for that.
Okay.
There's parts of the movie that feel like Lara Croft Tomb Raider or Indiana Jones. There's parts of the movie that feel like The Goonies.
Agreed. That was strange.
And the movie is set up almost exactly like a video game. Like, it feels like you're watching someone play a survival horror game. Way that the, you know, each set piece is set up with another goal or task, or, oh, we got to find the thing, or we got to solve this puzzle to get to through the next wall. Like, it is just screaming out video game plot. Another thing I think the movie has going for it, though, is they have the advantage of this really cool location. Yeah, there's miles of graves underneath the streets of Paris, and that is, you know, inherently a really creepy location. And what it does really well for a horror film is that when your characters can't see what's going to be around every corner, or they don't know what's going to be around every corner, and they can't see 10 feet ahead of them, and they're stuck in such a small place that they can't just run around, you know, it creates a lot of tense atmosphere inherently in the structure of your set pieces. What's really disappointing is when they do turn the corner and what they end up seeing is like, kind of like, ugh, okay. Like, it's, it, you know, as far as horror movie kind of spooks and creepy crawlies and that kind of stuff, there's nothing here that you've never seen before. It's not the, he doesn't really know how to set up a scare very well, or at least not in this movie. And as a horror movie, it kind of just fails. It's not that scary. It's not really that committed to being scary. But I kind of like the dumb, like, grown-up Goonies vibe of it. Like, if it had been more of an adventure film and wasn't found footage, which I kind of got over halfway through, but...
But that's the thing, is I think the location makes the found footage a little easier to kind of, like, a little bit more palpable. But when you start in the film, there's, like, no reason. Mm-hmm. You know, even though that they eventually introduce this reason because he's a documentarian. But the thing is, like, I think the ideas and a lot about the movie is really kind of actually would be kind of fun. Mm-hmm. In that dumb sort of, I think even as a dumb horror movie sort of way, it could be really fun.
Yeah.
You know, going down, finding hell, all this kind of stuff. I didn't mind the spooks around the corner necessarily as much as, I just don't think that the reason I don't think it works is because it just wasn't written very well. I think that there are some, I do think that the automatic atmosphere of the movie almost is a seller.
Yeah. It's just a cool location, and it's surprising that we haven't seen this done already. Like, that this idea wasn't already taken, because it kind of writes itself.
No. And again, like I said, like, if you're going to go at something about, like, demons and stuff like that, please don't have another, you know, demonologist and just go paint by the numbers exorcist.
Yeah.
This is a much more interesting way to go into it.
A different angle. Yeah.
Even though it doesn't necessarily work. But I don't know. I kind of agree with you. It's a weird sort of adventure, because you do sort of get into it on the way.
Yeah.
But at the same time, you know, it's sort of bad. So I don't necessarily highly recommend it, but I guess I moderately say don't see it in theaters if you really are looking for
something.
I don't know, something.
Yeah, I kind of feel
if
like
you're just really bored. Watch it.
You need to get out of the heat. Yeah. I kind of feel like this is like the type of horror movie that like a bunch of 13-year-olds would rent for a slumber party.
Yes.
Like, it's that kind of horror film. It's not particularly scary. It's not even really that good of a movie at all. But like I said, there's something sort of dorky and dopey about it, and kind of just, like, pulpy that I kind of enjoyed. On like a really base level. I probably maybe didn't enjoy it for the right reasons, but I kind of did sort of. By, like, you know, by the middle to the end of the movie, when I realized I'm not going to get the horror movie that I'd really like out of it, I kind of enjoyed it for what it was. Its ambitions are pretty low, so I didn't feel like it really, I had high expectations ever at any point in the movie.
Again, I guess that's the weird thing about it, is there was some positives in it that I was kind of like, huh, that made me, I mean... It's usually it goes the other way around. There's enough positives to make a lot of to make up for a lot of negatives.
Yeah.
But with this mixed bag, there's more negatives than there are positives. But the positives still make me kind of go, huh, that's interesting. But the film isn't interesting.
No, not really. And there, I mean, by the end of the movie, some of the rules they've set up for their black magic or whatever, they start to. I don't know. The rules they've set up aren't really like that consistent. And
I always am just hesitant about rules, because sometimes I think that, I don't know, especially I know you're supposed to in film or whatever, but most of the time the rules are pretty faulty anyways. I mean, if they set you up something, sometimes it can be, it can kind of inform you and let you kind of know, oh, this is going to happen.
Yeah.
But sometimes I think weird shit can happen in these films, and it's okay to just let it slide.
Well, I'm fine with weird shit, but there was some stuff that I just thought was just kind of a cop out, and then there was a few places where
they just jump down a giant hole and magically everything's okay. Yeah.
Yeah, not even necessarily that. More so when, like, they realize, oh, we forgot that thing, part of the video game thing. Oh, we forgot that thing, so we got to go back. And then for whatever, you know, when they're creeping forward, it's like danger, danger, danger. When they have to backpedal and find the thing that they forgot the first time or whatever, they have to figure out their way to get back through the set piece again. Sure. Just going backwards, it seems like all of the dangerous elements that they had to defeat on their way forward are now defeated. It's no longer a problem. So running backwards is no longer an issue. So in my head, I'm like, why not just follow your breadcrumbs and get out that way? I know there's like this weird circular, they're running in loops and they're kind of lost. But at the same time, I'm like, I don't know, just it took a lot of the tension out of whatever horror might have been there. And it kind of felt like, oh, okay, well then what's the point of even advancing?
Well, one thing I thought was okay, but they didn't really bring it back up is the one of the ghoulies mm-hmm. appeared and killed one of the other characters.
Right.
And in that, and when she goes to that same spot, there's no ghoul.
Exactly.
So so the only thing I guess you could speculate was that specifically because they kind of the premise is that whatever things that haunt you are coming back to haunt you kind of thing.
Right.
So is that just for that character? But they don't really address it, and it doesn't really... I don't mind that as much as... it makes sense that it's kind of like, oh, she has to do that all over again. There was a part of it that I kind of liked, and there's part of it I didn't like. I don't know. That didn't bother me as much as the other thing I mentioned earlier about jumping down holes and everything's magically okay.
Yeah. I mean...
I thought that was just a real, real cop-out.
I'm not going to say this movie's good, really at all, but I think it's kind of fine. Like, I don't have it in me to hate this movie. I kind of feel like if I was 13, I probably would dig it. But I will say, whoever saw this and just their mind was fucking blown, rent The Descent.
Right, or I can't say enough. I thought it was just... It was just kind of mediocre, and
yeah,
I don't think if you're a big horror fan, it'll do much for you. I don't think if you're a movie person who's trying to just see a good movie, I don't think it'll do much for you.
Yeah,
if you're a 13-year-old, yes, it might do it for you.
Yeah, or if you've lived in France and you get a kick out of seeing the catacombs in a movie.
I didn't even think the catacombs were that prominent in it. I mean, yes, they were down in tombs, but it wasn't like all the skull kind of architecture and stuff like that. There was just like small blips of it.
Yeah.
I mean, I thought it worked well as a set piece, and I thought, but you were in the undiscovered part of the catacombs. So, I mean, these could have been the undiscovered parts of the sewer system. It really didn't matter.
Yeah, yeah. And I'm sure
it could have been any city. The actual Paris thing doesn't add anything to it.
Yeah, and I'm sure that a lot of it was set after a point. All right. Well, let's go to the other French film. This one, Made in France, by a French director.
That was an accident, by the way.
I know. I just noticed this when I was watching our Netflix homework, which is Amélie, directed by Jean-Pierre Jeunet. In 2001, everyone has seen this movie but me, so you probably don't even need to hear me talk about it. And this is kind of a different movie for Jeunet at this point. Him and Marc Caro had started their careers with these sort of dystopian science fiction thrillers like City of Lost Children and Delicatessen, which are both kind of violent and sort of satirical. And then this movie was, the first movie that Jeunet did without Marc Caro. Or no, that was probably Alien Resurrection, but this is the first movie he did in France without Marc Caro. And it's sort of a romantic comedy of sorts. We have the main character, Amélie, that the movie's named after. She was sort of raised by eccentric parents. Her father was very distant and didn't believe in like hugging and caring. So, and the only time that she got human contact from her father was when he, as a doctor, would do checkups on her. And He's convinced that she's had a heart condition her whole life because her heart was fluttering because whatever, they were hugging in some sort of capacity. Mother dies at a young age, and then later in life she works at this bar, meets all these eccentric characters, all of whom have sort of these emotional stumbling blocks or character flaws that they need to get over. And in the process of trying to discover these weird mysteries around her life and fix things and fix people, she starts to sort of meddle around in other people's lives, sort of like a very French, very idiosyncratic, colorful, surreal version of like Emma or Clueless. I kind of liked it.
That's good. No, it's kind of actually interesting that you had never seen it to me. Mm-hmm. And that's why I was like, yeah. And this was kind of a featured on the shame list, you mm-hmm. know? I'm sure we each have one.
List of shames. Yeah.
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 And so it's a pretty decent movie. It's cute. I actually, what I thought was interesting about all the characters is, yes, it was a very eccentric way to portray them, mm-hmm. but I would say they were all very almost... what was eccentric is that they usually don't show these, you know, you have to have an interesting character, not mundane characters. And a lot of these are so mundane that they're almost interesting. They're so orderly. They're so neat. They're so, you know,
yeah.
It's weird because they set up in the movie, they take a long period of time to just kind of introduce their cast of characters.
Yeah. It's a big ensemble. And you kind of get to know the whole town, or everyone in her world anyway, all the people that she encounters every day, and they all kind of have these neuroses that they need to get over.
Well, it does a lot of world building for, and so you know more about the character because of what she's surrounded by.
Right.
Then you almost are introduced to the character at first, but it still builds to what you know about her.
Yeah.
So I thought that, I actually think that's kind of an interesting way to go in, and a kind of... Guy Ritchie kind of does the same thing, except his, you know, they make these sound effects and then they bring up these bright colors and they put their name at the bottom of them.
Yeah, but it's kind of in a very similar vein. I would say that exactly. a lot of this, especially like the first 25 minutes of it where we're being introduced to every character, what their situation is, the people they know, how they're going to behave for the movie, and all done with sort of this voiceover, reminded me a lot of a Wes Anderson film.
True. That's the thing I was thinking the most, because I just watched The Royal Tenenbaums not too long ago.
Which has a similar structure. Yeah.
And I was just thinking to myself, I was like, huh, that's kind of interesting. Mm-hmm. This is kind of...
And I believe they both came out the same year, 2001.
Yeah. So I don't know, it's a very cutesy film. I really liked it when it came out. Now that a few years have passed and I'm a more bitter, hard person, I suppose, or whatever. It's still cute, but it doesn't do much for me.
So did you rewatch it for this?
I did. Jackie had never seen it, so it was on, I guess, her list of shame.
Did she enjoy it? I feel like this movie really plays better for girls, and I don't mean that in a sexist way, but it just seems to.
Well, I think it also portrays a female differently than normal, so I think that helps. It doesn't, she's not so hopelessly, you know, looking for love and...
Yeah.
It's not a basic kind of romantic movie, but it's a romantic movie. So you get kind of that familiarity with it. But then you also get kind of some twists and turns with it. So, yeah, with her specifically, I think she enjoyed it. I don't think it was like...
It's pretty hard not to enjoy.
No, I mean, it's a charming movie.
Even if you're not really into the narrative or the emotional... aspect of the movie, it is stylish as fuck.
I think it's sort of a charming movie,
right? I think it borders from charming into precious at times,
sure,
and in a way that I don't respond to. I think Audrey Tautou, who plays the main character, there are certain times where I feel like she's being directed like a Barbie doll. Nothing against her performance. I think she was doing exactly what she was being told to do. But every once in a while, she seems extremely affected in a way that sort of turns me off. But the movie...
Is that maybe just because you're a shut-off person?
No, just the movie in general seems, it's so stylized. And
it is, no, it is.
And to, and so, to the point where it almost cuts you off. It almost sort of in that Wes Anderson-y way.
Oh, so you're talking about the over-stylization. You're not necessarily talking about the affectation of the characters. I see.
Well, that goes into it. They're being sort of contorted around to fit into this cartoon universe that's sort of
cartoony. Yeah.
Genet has created here. And sometimes it's good and it works, and sometimes I'm a little agitated. And in a way I never got from Delicatessen or City of Lost Children, which are a little darker movies.
Yeah, I guess I've never got that way, but so that's interesting. To me, it just kind of, it's light and breezy, and you drink it down, and then it's pretty much gone after that. I don't know, again, the things that stuck with me about this movie, I guess, over time, and why I think it has such an audience, I'm bringing this up again, and I apologize, but I think it's just the charm of the movie.
Right.
It's a little different, too. It's not your standard take. Again, and I think that the characters are so normal that it actually makes them feel abnormal in a lot of it. Because, I mean, her parents are just orderly and clean, and they're school teachers. They're not, you know, philanthropists, traveling adventurers who also happen to be the best people in the world.
Right.
And are going to save it from a nuclear explosion or whatever.
Yeah, it's sort of the grandiosity of this tiny little community.
Right.
Of these individuals in her life. We're supposed to see the world through her eyes, you know, and she's this very imaginative person, sort of in a Billy Liar sort of way, where we're seeing everything as stylized through the world as she envisions it.
It's definitely her POV, yeah.
Yeah, and I get that, and I understand, like, the mood and the atmosphere of the movie. And maybe to some degree, it's harder for me to look at this movie with clean eyes because I feel like this sort of thing is pretty well established in film language now. Mm-hmm. And we've seen this. I mean, hell, the Priceline roaming gnome came from this movie.
And maybe that's why, too, you know, maybe if you would have seen it when it first came out, you would have had a different attachment to it.
I'm pretty sure I would have. In 2001, this would have looked very different and would have played very different than it would now.
When the gnome thing happened, I was like, man, I forgot how kind of this kind of influence stuff. That's weird.
Yeah, they totally, I'm sure Genet probably gets money from those commercials.
Well, the funny thing about that is to think how much this film affected, you know, this little French film.
Yeah. This was a huge crossover hit.
And, you know, I do think that it kind of influenced other people.
Mm-hmm.
And you kind of, it has a very, it's a very twee sensibility before twee existed.
Yeah. And maybe that's sort of what turns me off a little bit from the movie. But like I said, I think you should be able to give it a little bit more benefit of a doubt, knowing that this was sort of new at the time.
This is like post, or no, this is pre-twee, post-twee.
Proto-twee, if you will.
Proto-twee, good.
Yeah, it's nice. It's fun, and actually a lot of the problems that I have with the movie are kind of ironed out by the time we get into the thick of the plot. Okay. Once we get to better establish a view of these characters, the camera work calms down a little bit. Her affectation, you know, she, instead of this kind of frozen grin on her face, she starts to act like a real human being. By the end of the movie, it was a lot more invested in the humanity of it, which I felt was a little cut off at the start.
Well, again, you're getting her view. See, to me, it was the world building. It was like, you got to know the character through the things around her, mm-hmm. what has informed her. And so I don't know. I never got that, but that's interesting.
All right. Well, next week, the movie I'm going to have us watch for a Netflix homework, anything we mentioned in this segment can be viewed on the Netflix instant streaming. Have you seen Blue Ruin yet?
No, I haven't.
This is being talked a lot about this year, like in like random places. I see people like, oh, that Blue Ruin movie. And I keep meaning to see it. So it just popped on the queue. So we should watch it.
Sounds good. I'll at least give it a go. Give it the HBO try.
Or the Netflix try, as it were.
That's true, too. That's the new...
And before my list pops up, do you have anything? Never mind, it's up. Okay.
Well, what if I wanted to add something? Nope. No, I have nothing to add.
Your window of opportunity is gone.
You closed it before it even got open.
If you'd like to respond to any of the things we've talked about today, as below, as above, so below, or Amelie, or next week's movie, Blue Ruin, or anything we discuss in the news, you can contact us at our email, which is jabberinthedrone@gmail.com. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter, at Jabber Podcast, or facebook.com/JabberPodcast. Like us there. You can see anytime we post news items or updates about the show, or if you just have any general questions you want to pose to us. We are also on iTunes and Stitcher Radio and Pocket Cast, so you can listen to us on your favorite mobile device. You can read the movie reviews that I do every week for the Idaho State Journal at salafarkreviews.blogspot.com, as well as the content I provide every once in a while for the Seattle-based website, mcguff.in/author/Cassidy. Richard's blog, be sure to check out that at rdwally.weebly.com. And check out the stuff that Brad and Amanda is doing over at the Quarter Life Crisis podcast at quartercrisis.podbean.com. And go check out Dampercast as well. Leland was a sport for coming on last week for our 100th episode, and he's been name-dropping us a lot on the podcast. So be sure to listen to them and leave them a review on iTunes as well. Until then, we will talk to you on episode 102.
Woo! Have a good one.
You too. Bye.